One, two.
It's a very special Oscar edition of Culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby. Nominations were announced today for the Academy Awards, and we featured many of the contenders in the last year on NPR. This year is the first time in decades that there have been 10 Best Picture nominees. Here's a selection of features about many of the 10. We're going to begin with the two films that have tied for the most nominations, Avatar and The Hurt Locker.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross.
And I'm Madeline Brand. I'm sitting in for Michelle Norris while she's on book leave. The new movie, The Hurt Locker, is about American soldiers who defuse bombs in Iraq. Unlike many war films, it's not obsessed with action or violence, but with the tension just before. At the center of The Hurt Locker is Will James. He's an expert bomb technician who doesn't like to follow the rules. He's played by Jeremy Renner.
You know there are guys watching us right now. They're laughing at this, okay? And I'm not okay with that. But turn off your goddamn torch, because we're going.
Jeremy Renner playing Will James in The Hurt Locker. I spoke with Jeremy Renner earlier. He told me that they shot the movie in Jordan last summer with temperatures as high as 130 degrees. Jeremy Renner said that he and the other actors spent a lot of time living like real soldiers.
It was hell, I'm not going to lie. You know, it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. Always trying to check myself. Realizing, like, I'm just shooting a movie, but it's so hard to think clearly, even in that kind of heat, and then with the bomb suit on, and then I couldn't explain the hell that we all went through for those 3 months. I couldn't do it. I could only talk to Brian Garrity and Anthony Mackie. And
your co-stars.
Because we had a very difficult time, especially Brian and I, coming back to the States. I mean, I didn't leave the house for 3 months. I had a hard time getting acclimated back into watching girls paint their toenails and get their lattes. It was really tough for me. And it was one of those things, you don't see cameras. The sets were a square mile. You never knew who was in the movie, who wasn't. So it felt as real as it possibly would ever feel, except I never felt that my life was on the line. It tested everybody on a personal level. Divorces were happening, and it was chaos for a lot of people. It was no smooth sailing by any means. And would I ever do it again? I doubt it. I don't know if I have the strength to. And we're just shooting a movie, right? I'm just some silly actor in a silly movie. Not so much in this experience.
Today's next guests are the movie's screenwriter, Mark Boal, and its director, Catherine Bigelow.
Catherine, the first IED that we see go off it's close to the beginning of the film. And it's a really horrifying moment. I mean, you basically see, and I think you shot this part of this in slow motion, you basically see the pavement lift up and fragment and fly into the air. And then everything else just kind of explode around it into this, you know, ball of debris. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene and making it have real impact? And by that I mean, it's not special effects impact. There's so many movies where things are always blowing up and it's visually dazzling, but you don't necessarily feel anything. You're just thinking like, wow, pretty cool, stuff blowing up, big special effects. But this, you really feel the threat and the impact and the danger and the horror.
Well, I wanted to really put the viewer at the epicenter of the event and, you know, really feel that horror.
Part of the drama in The Hurt Locker comes from those moments when the person from the bomb squad, whose job it is to defuse the bomb, puts on the suit and does the walk alone to the bomb. And it seems like it would be one of the most lonely moments imaginable, because you're cut off from the world by virtue of wearing this 90-pound suit, protective suit. And then also, it's just like you there, basically right next to the bomb, trying to defuse it. Mark, would you talk a little bit about the reality of that situation, like what you witnessed when it was time for one of the men to take that walk alone?
It's an everyday occurrence, so I don't want to over-dramatize it, but there is something extremely iconic about that, and the bomb techs always talk about that walk, and it's really a mark of honor if you've done it, and it's really hard to quantify or explain if you haven't. But basically, once you put on that suit and you start walking towards the bomb, you're in a world at a certain point in which there is no turning back. And if the bomb goes off, you're dead. If you turn around and run and the bomb goes off, you're dead. So the only option is to really go right into the teeth of the matter and defuse it.
Director Catherine Bigelow and screenplay writer Mark Boal of The Hurt Locker speaking to Terry Gross last year.
You are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
The world of Avatar germinated in the brain of writer and director James Cameron about 15 years ago. Now it's on screens in eye-popping 3D. The bioluminescent jungles of the moon Pandora, with its indigenous population, the blue 10-foot-tall Na'vi.
Na'vi.
Avatar is a live-action film using revolutionary computer-generated, or CG, technology. The team developed head rig cameras for the actors to record nuances of facial expression that were then digitally transformed. James Cameron shot the movie on a vast gray performance capture stage called The Volume.
So visualize a warehouse space. It was actually a place where Howard Hughes worked on the Spruce Goose. But it's maybe 120 feet long by 80 feet wide. And within that is a smaller space that's lined out on the floor, which defines the perimeter of the volume with a red line. And when you step over that red line, you're stepping into a space that's scanned by 120 or 130 cameras that are overhead on a pipe grid. And they photograph these markers that are on the actors' bodies, and that becomes a computer-generated character. Then that character gets exported to another program called Motion Builder, and this is all happening in the space of a few milliseconds. And in Motion Builder, it puts that character into an environment. So in a sense, you're creating a kind of live video game of the performance of the scene.
There's a scene in the movie where Zoe Saldana's character, Neytiri, is teaching the avatar of Jake Sully how to ride a banshee, these giant flying lizards. Let's take a listen here.
To become Aronio, hunter, you must choose your own Ikran, and he must choose you.
When?
When you are ready.
And off she goes on that banshee.
Off she goes.
Now, what's she actually doing when she's on that stage in this volume that you're describing? Is she actually riding on something?
Right. Well, there were a couple of things there. When she jumped onto the back of the creature, believe it or not, she was actually jumping onto the back of a really big stunt guy, like a 280-pound linebacker stunt guy. The object there was to have her land onto an organically moving platform, if you will. And then as she flies, we put her on a different rig, which is the Banshee flying rig, which is basically a big fiberglass Banshee on a two-axis gimbal. And that was moved around by stunt guys. Now, it's not moving through space. It's just sort of rotating in place.
What were some of the flaws in other CGI, computer-generated imagery films, that you saw that you were trying to improve here? What do you think you were trying to do to make it better?
Honestly, I just didn't think they were doing it right. They weren't getting any information from how the eyes are moving. They weren't seeing how the tongue and the lips and the teeth were interacting with each other to form syllables and sounds. And so by uncoupling the facial capture from the body capture, which is what we did on Avatar, and using this head rig or this image-based system, we really got every bit of detail that was needed to reproduce the actor's performance later in the CG character. And I mean down to every tiny amount of tension around the mouth or around the eyes, every blink, every tiny dart, and that all translated exactly to the final characters, which gave a real sense of truth and life to these characters.
Do you have a favorite creature or plant from the movie?
I guess I like the banshees the best. The one I had the most direct design input on was the Thanator, where I designed its head and upper body. But we had a creature design team, and we broke it up so that different groups were working on different creatures.
Well, James Cameron, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Tarantino wrote and directed the new movie Inglourious Basterds. He sets loose a squad of men to cause havoc inside German-occupied France in the 1940s. The movie quickly takes you into a parallel universe of outrageous violence and a plan to kill Adolf Hitler. The characters switch between English, German, French, and Italian. And Quentin Tarantino's dialogue in between killings drips with dark humor.
It's just kind of the way I write. There is a comedy aspect to everything that I've ever done.
You know, I stop short of calling them comedies because there's actually serious stuff in the films.
You stop short of calling them comedies because people are being scalped and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, little things like that, all right? But that doesn't mean we can't have a good time. All right. But my but it's the humor comes out of it. And it comes out of just the way I do things. But also part of my method of doing stuff is to make people laugh at stuff that's not normally funny.
My name is Lieutenant Aldo Rain, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers. 8 Jewish American soldiers. And once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis.
I'd like to know, as best you can describe it, how you go about writing a scene like that. Do you practice lines on people? Do you just sit alone and it comes out of your head? What happens?
Yeah, it's the sitting alone coming out of my head scenario that's the closest. I mean, basically, I just get the characters talking to each other. And then they do it. They really write the scene. I'm more like a court reporter. Jotting it down. All right, the whole trick is to get them talking to each other, and then when I'm done writing the scene, then Quentin, the writer, comes in and just kind of cleans it up just a little bit.
And you also have said this isn't your daddy's World War II movie. what were you thinking about when you said that?
Well, that comment, you know, it's there's been certain contrivances, especially when it comes to language, where people are supposed to be speaking German, but it's standing in for, you know, they're speaking English and it's supposed to be German.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a contrivance that we've put up with for a long time. And I think that day is over. I actually think it makes when, you know, movies take place in Nazi Germany and they're all speaking English, or in particular, almost Shakespearean English. All right. It's like you would think the Third Reich started at the Old Vic. all these Shakespearean actors walking through the door. I think it makes them quaint. There is an aspect that this movie, one of the things that's about, is about language. And that was such a big, big deal in World War II. I mean, people died and were shot and thrown in ditches because they couldn't understand a German order. You know, and also you have to remember something else that I think was very fascinating. World War II is the last time that a whole bunch of white people fought another whole bunch of white people. And consequently, if you could pull off language, you could infiltrate somebody else's army, whether it's the Germans infiltrating the Polish underground or the Czech underground, or whether it's, you know, us trying to infiltrate the Germans.
I want to ask one other question. Again, I'm trying very hard not to give the ending away, even though I want to
ask about
that,
it. And I appreciate that, by the way.
But let's just say also that the ending involves, setting some film on fire. You ever done that?
No, I haven't, because it's actually really hard nowadays to get nitrate film prints. But one of the things you look for as a writer is to have these little eureka ideas. And I think, you know, the better writer you are, the more eureka ideas you've had in your life. You've got two things going on. On one hand, the idea that cinema is going to try to bring down the Third Reich, that's a really juicy metaphor. On another hand, it's not even a metaphor at all. It's a tactile reality in the movie. It is 35mm nitrate film itself that is doing it.
Well, Quentin Tarantino, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Hey, it's a very good conversation. Thanks a lot.
Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds opens today.
The new movie titled Up from Pixar Animation is about what happens if you tie 20,622 helium balloons to your house. Up is directed by longtime Pixar animator Pete Docter, who also wrote the story and screenplay. Pete Docter, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here.
And let's talk about the inspiration for this character of the grumpy old man, Carl Fredrickson. Where did he come from?
Yeah, well, Bob Peterson and I, Bob is the co-writer and co-director on the film, and we kept drawing pictures, and I drew this really grumpy, grouchy guy with this happy, fun bunch of colorful balloons, and it just seemed like there was something interesting there, and we started playing with that, and that was the origins of the movie.
So you drew him originally holding balloons.
Yeah, there was something about, I guess, balloons somehow seem to be like a metaphor somehow for life, that there is something very temporal about them. You only have them for a short amount of time. They either, you accidentally let go and they float away, or they shrivel and they're gone. And there was something about that that seemed to relate to relationships and life that Bob and I started playing with. And we came up with this little relationship between this old man and this wilderness explorer who has every single badge that he needs except his assisting the elderly badge, and that's why he's been pestering Carl.
And this is the character of Russell, this wilderness explorer, and he is voiced by, I gather, a newcomer, somebody who had not done work like this before.
Yeah, he was voiced by this kid named Jordan Nagai, who wasn't actually even going to try out initially. We had to work a little bit to get to some of the acting things, but, you know, so I would trick him into doing certain things, having to run around, jump up and down, or I'd have to hold his arms by his side and say, okay, now, as he's, because we wanted some struggle kind of vocalization. So try and get your arms free as you're saying this line. So I want to help, you know, or whatever the line was. So
oh, you'd be physically restraining him so his voice would sound right.
Yeah, with his permission, of course.
Of course, and his mother. And the other leading character here is this gigantic, multicolored, fabulous bird that they discover in South America, who Russell promptly names Kevin. How did you come up with what Kevin the bird should look like?
Well, Kevin was a tricky character to design, and Ricky Nirvan, the other design team, we studied tons of real-life birds, starting with these kind of cranes and herons, and you know, for the sort of anatomy, we actually brought in a live ostrich here to Pixar, which, you know, just another day at work having an ostrich running around on the lawn. And then we studied this thing called a monal pheasant, which is, I think they said, the most iridescent bird on Earth, which is this beautiful, multicolored. They're found in the highlands of China, I think. At any rate, Kevin is kind of an amalgam of all these things, these elements that we liked from real birds, and we created this made-up one.
How important is it to you to balance the obvious fun and excitement and pure joy of movies like this and the sort of the darker and deeper underlying themes that are all over this movie? I mean, there's an absentee father, and there's the loss of a lifelong love. How do you make those two things mesh, and how important is it that there are both of those things in this movie?
We discovered early on that the story we were telling was basically about what real adventure in life is, and you know how so often we think of adventure as travel to exotic places and seeing fantastic creatures and sights that no one else has seen, and really what Carl comes to discover is that the truth, the thing that adventure really is this wonderful relationship that he had with his wife. And so even though he never got the former, he definitely had the latter. And we needed to show that in the movie. To me, that's what makes those movies stick with you. You know, they're a lot of fun, a lot of action and adventure. But unless you have that emotional kind of touchstone and foundation, it doesn't really stay with you as you leave the theater. And that's what we were trying for in this film.
Well, Pete Docter, it's been great talking with you. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Pete Docter is the director of the new film, Up. Jason Reitman's resume as a film director isn't just impressive, it's stunning when you consider that Reitman just turned 32 in October. He has made Thank You for Smoking, Juno, and now Up in the Air, in which George Clooney makes a lifestyle out of frequent flying, going from city to city helping companies fire people, and giving motivational speeches, preaching freedom from social and familial ties. Well, as my co-host Robert Siegel found out, that does not describe Jason Reitman.
Now, after seeing a screening of Up in the Air, which I enjoyed tremendously, I picked up a copy of Walter Kern's novel Up in the Air.
And Walter will be very pleased with that.
Well, he should be. And I would say of the two, there are many similarities between his novel and the film. But this is not just an adaptation of a novel to a movie.
Well, there's key elements that I've added. Now, Walter's book is about Ryan Bingham, a man who fires people for a living, who lives his entire life on the road, airplane to airplane, hotel to hotel, collecting air miles religiously and living alone. That's kind of his primary philosophy, that he wants to live without anyone or anything. And that's something that I really locked into. Now, from there, I injected a lot of my own plot, including two women, a character named Alex, played by Vera Farmiga, and a character named Natalie, played by Anna Kendrick, who really become the challenge to Ryan's philosophy.
And a family wedding enjoys a role in the film, which is kind of off-screen in the novel. It's not nearly so significant. And the kind of Goldman Sachs McKinsey of management consulting, which is the sort of off-screen Moby Dick of the novel's life, is totally missing. This is a significant variation on the novel.
Well, I think it's better when you say it than I do. I think if I said it, it would come off a little arrogant. But coming from you, it really makes me look better. So I appreciate that.
Now, the character George Clooney plays, Ryan Bingham, fires people for a living. He's a consultant who's retained to do what Walter Kern refers to, at least as a career transition consulting, in explaining to people what happens now that you don't have a job. And you have people who play the part of people who've lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. Some of them are actors, but not all of them are actors.
We were location scouting in St. Louis and Detroit, two cities that really got hit hard. And it just became clear to me that we should use real people, people who had actually lost their jobs. So we put an ad out in both local papers saying we were making a documentary about job loss. And they would go through a 10-minute process where we would interview them, and then we would actually tell them, we'd like to now fire you on camera. And when they would hear those words, you'd see them change. One girl just literally just broke into hives across her neck as she's in the film. So there was something about being in that moment amongst people who you could tell had not really talked about this to anybody. They said the kinds of things that I would never have thought to write as a writer.
If you had actually made this film up in the air before being happily sidetracked to make Thank You for Smoking, it would have been a totally different film.
It would have been a different movie for many reasons. I mean, one, because the economy would have been better, but more importantly, I wouldn't have grown up yet.
Well, Jason Reitman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Are you kidding me? It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Director Jason Reitman, his latest film is Up in the Air.
Lee Daniels directed the new film Precious. Set in Harlem in 1987, it's about a 350-pound illiterate 16-year-old African-American girl who is physically abused by her mother and pregnant by her father for the second time. Sounds pretty grim, but Daniels finds the strength in this girl, and he gets terrific dramatic performances from Mariah Carey, the comic Monique, and newcomer Gabourey Sidibe, who plays Precious. The movie is based on the novel Push by Sapphire. Let's start with a scene. Precious is talking with her welfare caseworker, played by Mariah Carey. Here's Carey and Gabourey Sidibe.
You don't even like me.
Have we not been in this room together for like a year discussing your life?
Does that mean we like each other because we discuss my life?
I can't speak for you. I can only speak for me. And I do like you.
Lee Daniels, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me agree with everybody who says that Gabourey Sidibe, who plays Precious, really does an extraordinary job. And she wasn't a professional actress. How did you put out the call? I mean, did you have a casting call for 350-pound teenagers? I mean, how did you find her?
I called an agent in Hollywood and said, listen, can you help me? I'm looking for a 355-pound black girl. And there was silence on the phone. And I realized at that point, okay, well, here we go. I got to attack this from a completely different way of that I ordinarily attack the casting process. So that meant, work, a lot of work. But my brilliant casting director, Billy Hopkins, and my sister in Los Angeles, Leah Daniels Butler, began a search for the girl. They saw, if I saw 400 girls, over 400, they had to have seen at least 1,000 girls. And we actually narrowed it down to like 20 girls. And these girls were in a Precious camp where they were dancing. And that was really a great time. It was a different type of way of casting. I wish we had done footage on it or even a reality show, because each week a girl would be dropped off. And these girls were...
It was like a Precious training camp you're talking about.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, they were dancing. They were having acting lessons. And it was so beautiful watching these girls who I'd find at McDonald's. Or we flew in from, a Radio Shack in Chicago.
Wait. Let's stop right there. So you'd go up to somebody at McDonald's and and say, well, they look heavy. they look fat and maybe talented. I will go up to them. I mean,
yeah. They immediately, it was not as easy as you would think, you know? So anyway, we had these 20 girls narrowed down. They were the real girls. These girls really were, you know, they had problems speaking and their diction. And Gabby came in. She auditioned. It was a great audition. And then when I meant to meet her, she started talking like this white girl from the Valley. And I just thought, my God, this is, who are you? And I realized at that moment, if I had used one of the girls, that I would have been exploiting them. And it would not have been, I would have made a mockery of Precious. So this girl is not Precious. And so she's, you know, she has a different life. And she's, though she's from Harlem, she's very worldly. And really have a sense of self-confidence that either, I don't know, I've never seen anything like it before in my life. She is truly, you know, either in denial about her physicality or she's on a higher plane. I know she's got several boyfriends. She's so secure with who she is that it's mind-blowing.
You also got a terrific performance out of Monique, who's best known as a comic and talk show host. She plays the mother, the very emotionally and physically abusive mother. How did you know that Monique could pull that off?
We're very good friends. And I had already worked with her before in Shadowboxer. I knew that Monique would tear it out. So it was just something intuitive. I've rarely been wrong about an actor.
Now, Mariah Carey, you cast as a social worker. You'd also work with her on Tennessee, which you produced. And she's really good in this role. She's very convincing. How did you prepare her for it?
It starts with the walk. You know, Mariah's had stiletto pumps on since she's been an embryo. And she walks on her tippy toes, even out of her pumps. That's how trained her feet are to walk in stilettos. So for her homework assignment, she had to learn to walk on the palms of her and the heels of her feet. So that was very hard for her. And then I had her open them up so that she was sort of walking like a duck. And that started a character. We sort of, you know, went on from there. We went by deepening the voice. And I studied every, because I'm friends with her, so I know every Mariah thing that she does. And so everything that she does, we had to undo for this character.
My guest is Lee Daniels. He directed the new film Precious, and he produced the film Monsters Ball. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nick Hornby, the author of High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, About a Boy, and the new novel Juliet Naked. He adapted his memoir Fever Pitch into a film. Now he's written the adaptation of a memoir by the British journalist Lynn Barber. The movie, An Education, stars Peter Sarsgaard, Alfred Molina, and Carey Mulligan. One of the producers, Amanda Posey, is Hornby's wife. An Education opens October 9th. I want you to just kind of set up what the story is about in An Education, because I let you give away as much as you're comfortable giving away in that description, so that we could talk a little bit about the movie.
Well, it's a movie about a 16-year-old girl who turns 17 during the course of the film, called Jenny, and her relationship with an inappropriate and slightly dodgy older man in London right at the beginning of the 1960s.
The screenplay is based on a memoir by a woman, Lynn Barber, who's a journalist in England who I gather writes a lot of celebrity profiles and things like that.
Yeah, she. I guess she's quite famous for turning on people. she's written the odd, quite sort of notorious profile of celebrities. When she doesn't like them, she lets you know that she doesn't like them.
I found it really interesting that you were so passionate about this story that you wanted to adapt it into a film. You're so well known for writing mostly about a certain male point of view. Why did you want to write from this female point of view and from the dangers that a woman in high school faces?
I started to think of it really as a female equivalent of my first book, Fever Pitch, which was a memoir about soccer, but where soccer seemed to provide some kind of direct route into the life of the city. So there was that attracted me to it immediately. And then the more I started to think about it, the more I liked other things in it. I loved it tonally. I thought it was painful and funny at the same time. And most things just kind of go into a groove and stay there. They're either funny or they're not funny. And I love things that make you laugh and cry, and that material doesn't come around very often.
Nick Hornby's new novel is called Juliet Naked. He wrote the screenplay for the new film, An Education. Here's Peter Sarsgaard and Carey Mulligan in a scene from the film.
I suppose you have homework to do.
You have no idea how boring everything was before I met you. Action is character, our English teacher says. I think it means that if we never did anything, we wouldn't be anybody. And I never did anything before I met you.
The actress who plays Jenny is 24-year-old Carey Mulligan, and her performance has so charmed critics that the words Oscar contender are now inevitably attached to her name. Carey Mulligan joins us from New York, where she's been filming Wall Street 2 with director Oliver Stone. Carey Mulligan, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Jenny seems to me to be so, you know, on one hand, so innocent and naive and giggly. You have these wonderful dimples and this incredible little laugh. But at the same time, there's such wisdom on your face in this part, even while, as a viewer, you know that you were headed towards some disastrous fall. Is that how it was written in the script? Is that what you picked up from the director or the writer?
It was in the script. I mean, she was the most intelligent girl in her class, so she, you know, that kind of adds a little bit. Also, it wasn't really, from my understanding, a time where, you know, there were no teenagers. You were either a child or you were a young adult. You know, the teenage thing kind of kicked in the following years. You know, this is pre-Beatles and pre-swinging 60s, and it's still post-war. You know, the first couple of years of her life, she still would have been on rationing. You know, it wasn't a fun society. It was kind of a getting on surviving society still. People still had all that in their minds. And she was written very intelligently and she was very witty. And in a way, Jenny does know, you know, she's headed into something not brilliant. I mean, she's not naive to it, which is why it doesn't feel like she's being taken advantage of in a sort of inappropriate way, because she kind of drives certainly the romantic side of the relationship more than Peter Sarsgaard character David does.
There's a scene when David, the older man, takes you to Paris, and you are sort of dancing along the Seine, and your hair is in this fantastic updo, and you're wearing this very slim sleeveless sheath dress, and you're very bird-like, you're a very tiny person, and you know the Audrey Hepburn comparisons are just right in front of you as a viewer.
God, it's hugely, enormously, madly flattering, but it's too sort of crazy to think about. It's just very kind of, it's like, that's nicer than being compared to Shrek or something.
Well, Carey Mulligan, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The movie District 9 opens with the ominous arrival of a huge spaceship.
Now, to everyone's surprise, the ship didn't come to a stop over Manhattan or Washington or Chicago, but instead coasted to a halt directly over the city of Johannesburg.
That spaceship carries creepy-looking aliens, but District 9 is more than another alien-infested sci-fi flick. It uses its South African setting to touch on themes of apartheid, xenophobia, and redemption. District 9 has been a hit in the U.S. since it opened earlier this month, and over the weekend it premiered in South Africa. We were curious how the film would be received there, and reporter Amy Costello went to find out.
Many of those emerging from theaters over the weekend responded to subtleties in District 9 that may have been lost on many American audiences. Start with the film's title.
In some ways, a little bit shocking, just thinking of District 6.
That's Christo Skitter. He's referring to Cape Town's District 6, a neighborhood just a few miles from the cinema from which thousands of South Africans were forcibly removed during apartheid. Skitter said watching the graphic, hyper-real removals of aliens from their homes by South African security forces in the fictional District 9 made him reflect on the real-life forced removals in Cape Town's District 6. But for Jamela Hovani, a 26-year-old black South African, imagery of her nation's ugly past is a bad message to send out to the rest of the world.
It was a representation of the old South Africa, you know, like apartheid state, the white people running the police state, and the black people living in the slums. Just the whole setup of the movie, it reminded me of the whole apartheid era.
The film's numerous graphic scenes of forced removals by heavily armed troops provided a visceral flashback of recent real-life violence in South Africa. Last year, the nation was rocked by a series of deadly xenophobic attacks on foreigners. Fortune Sabanda, himself a foreigner, said the film's apparent message of tolerance was undermined at every turn by a liberal use of what he sees as racial and ethnic stereotypes. Sabanda points to the masses of impoverished blacks and aliens living in shantytowns.
I think what it does is to look at Africa from, I'm sorry to say, but from white eyes. You know what I'm saying? The fear that the African is a cannibal who wants to eat other people to assimilate their power. So in trying to do all that, I think the movie totally failed at the end of the day.
For NPR News, I'm Amy Costello in Cape Town, South Africa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.